deed which can shake trust in democracy and the parliamentary system. Thus, it is good that the Belgian authorities are thoroughly investigating.
At their summit, EU leaders refused to be drawn on the question of possible sanctions against Qatar. However, they signed off on more sanctions against Russia and also Iran. The leaders agreed to provide at least 20 billion euro to Ukraine in 2023. Campaigners say they should be doing more for their own citizens.
So many people in poverty, like everything what's going on from the crisis from 2008 until now, nothing changed.
It's clear that things could soon get a lot worse if the EU fails to secure a reliable long-term energy source at the right price. The costly Ukrainian refugee crisis is also growing by the day. So the final EU leaders summit of 2022 has now concluded. Analysts say the unprecedented challenges they will face in 2023 could stretch the EU project beyond breaking point. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
While the West is expanding sanctions against Moscow and Iran over their military cooperation, the potential for developing relations between the two countries is huge, since Russia and Iran are under tough Western sanctions and therefore have little to fear.
The will of our governments is interconnected. Our high-ranking officials and our peoples do not pay attention to the shouts of the entire West and continue to strengthen their ties and interaction.
At the press conference held in Moscow, Iran's ambassador to Russia summed up the outcome of relations between Moscow and Iran in 2022. He noted that Russia's ruble is used in more than 40% of trade between the two countries, and that the Russian currency may become the main one in bilateral trade. According to his remarks, Tehran supported the idea of using the ruble as the main currency in regional unions such as the EAEU. He also referred to efforts to integrate the national payment systems MIR and SHETAP as part of financial and economic cooperation between Russia and Iran. According to the Iranian envoy, Russia and Iran are seeking to reduce the dominance of certain currencies, including the dollar, in bilateral trade and economic relations. Jalali further said the automotive industry and space sector have become another field of cooperation between the two countries. In August, Russia launched remote sensing satellite Hayam into orbit on behalf of Iran.
As for our negotiations, I want to say that negotiations between our respective organizations in the field of outer space are ongoing on a regular basis.
Iran is investigating the possibility of producing cars jointly with Russia. Two leading automakers of the Islamic Republic, Saipa and Iran Hadro, took part in last summer's exhibition in Moscow and held negotiations with the Russian side. In addition to the joint production, the two countries are also discussing the possibility of sending Iranian cars to Russia. Russian and Iranian officials have time and again said that the two countries are determined to further expand bilateral cooperation. They have expressed confidence that the aim will materialize despite all the challenges the two nations might face, given the numerous capacities the two sides have. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., House Democrats are trying to introduce legislation to bar Donald Trump from office under the 14th Amendment. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CBS News has covered this story, telling us more. House Democrats on Thursday, 15th of December, introduced legislation that would bar former President Donald Trump from holding any federal office in the future, citing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The legislation is spearheaded by Democratic Representative David Cicilline of Rhode Island, who was a House manager for Trump's second impeachment. And the bill also has 40 co-sponsors, all of them Democrats. It cites the provision in the 14th Amendment that says no one who has held government office and who engaged in insurrection or rebellion shall be able to hold federal office again. Donald Trump very clearly engaged in an insurrection on 6th of January 2021 with the intention of overturning the lawful and fair results of the 2020 election. David Cicilline argued in a statement. He added, "You don't get to lead a government you try to destroy. Even Mitch McConnell admits that Donald Trump bears responsibility, saying on the Senate floor that there is no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of 6th of January 2021. The 14th Amendment makes clear that based on his past behavior, Donald Trump is disqualified from ever holding federal office again, and under Section 5, Congress has the power to pass legislation to implement this prohibition, Cicilline added. The legislation goes into detail about how Donald Trump pushed then-Vice President Mike Pence to refuse to certify the election results, failed to do anything to denounce the mob assaulting the Capitol for hours, and intervened with government officials who didn't support his false claims of mass election fraud, among other things. The bill would need to pass both chambers of Congress with only days before Republicans take control of the House of Representatives and a substantial end-of-year agenda remaining. The legislation drops as the House Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 assault on the Capitol prepares to release its final report next week. That committee is only authorized to operation until the end of the year. The Hill newspaper has also covered the same story. A group of 40 House Democrats, led by Representative David Cicilline from Rhode Island, introduced legislation on Thursday, 15th of December, to bar former President Donald Trump from holding future federal office under the 14th Amendment. Section 3 of the amendment states that no one who previously took an oath to support the Constitution and engaged in insurrection or rebellion shall hold any office, civil or military, under the United States. Representative David Cicilline said in a release announcing the legislation that Trump very clearly engaged in an insurrection on 6th of January 2021 with the intention of overturning the results of the 2020 presidential election. "You don't get to lead a government you try to destroy," he said. The release states that the bill includes testimony and evidence demonstrating how Donald Trump engaged in the insurrection. The bill also specifically describes how Trump helped encourage the violence on 6th of January 2021, tried to intimidate state and federal officials when they did not support his false claims of the election being stolen, and refused to denounce the mob that stormed the Capitol building for hours during the riot. The 14th Amendment makes clear that based on his past behavior, Donald Trump is disqualified from ever holding federal office again, and under Section 5, Congress has the power to pass legislation to implement this prohibition, Cicilline said. David Cicilline, who served as an impeachment manager during Donald Trump's first impeachment, sent a letter to his Democratic colleagues last month to solicit co-sponsors for a bill to bar Donald Trump from holding office. Trump was impeached on a charge of incitement of insurrection in the aftermath of 6th of January 2021, but he was acquitted by the Senate. This was the second time that Trump was impeached, with the first one coming in December of 2019. Last month, Donald Trump became the first major candidate to announce a run for the presidency in 2024. The 14th Amendment was ratified in the aftermath of the American Civil War when ex-Confederates and seceded states rejoined the Union. Fox News Channel has also covered the same story and tells us more. A group of 40 House Democrats have put forward legislation that would bar former President Donald Trump from holding public office again under the 14th Amendment. Representative David Cicilline, a Democrat from Rhode Island, one of the House Democrats who led the second impeachment effort against Trump, introduced legislation on Thursday, 15th of December, with 40 Democratic co-sponsors that would invoke Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to prevent Trump from returning to the White House or holding any other office. The amendment states, "No person shall hold any office, civil or military, under the United States, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof." Democrats argue that this language, adopted in the 1860s to prevent former Confederates from occupying positions in the federal government after the Civil War, should be applied to Donald Trump, who they allege incited an insurrection against the United States on 6th of January 2021. Donald Trump very clearly engaged in an insurrection on 6th of January 2021 with the intention of overturning the lawful and fair results of the 2020 presidential election. "You don't get to lead a government you tried to destroy," David Cicilline said in a statement. The statement added, "Even Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell admits that Trump bears responsibility, saying on the Senate floor that there is no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of 6th of January 2021. The 14th Amendment makes clear that based on his past behavior, Donald Trump is disqualified from ever holding federal office again, and under Section 5, Congress has the power to pass legislation to implement this prohibition. Democrats say their legislation details testimony and evidence collected by the House Select Committee on the January 6th riot and reports on the events of that day to make the case that Donald Trump helped to plan and to encourage an insurrection to overturn the lawful results of the 2020 presidential election. Last month, Donald Trump announced his candidacy for president in 2024 in Palm Beach, Florida.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's capital, Tehran, has been host to a forum called the Tehran Dialogue Forum. It's themed to push regional friendship, attended by nearly 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries. The focus was on the policy of the Islamic Republic towards its neighbors and its approach to friendship and trust building. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Iran's policy initiatives and how the region and the world can actually benefit from the enhanced relations between Iran and its neighbors, minus the presence of the U.S. in the West Asia region, and without Israeli interference.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension due to the new dimension in the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We can only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014. And we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020. And as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Yusumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Time to introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Mohammad Ali Araki joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from London. Also joining us, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who also joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Sayed Mohsen Abbas, I will start with you and ask you about the necessity for this Tehran Dialogue Forum in the first place. Taking a look at the platform in terms of what it says, I'm going to put it in a short format so you can elaborate more for us. Platform of interaction and communications among political officials and thinkers, which focuses on the West Asia region in particular. Do you think that this is a forum that is necessary, of course, with Iran being the host?
I think it's one of the most necessary initiatives for that West Asian region that there could possibly be, because, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been an advocate of peace and regional security since the revolution, without a doubt. I mean, just some examples to show the history of Iran's engagement, this persistent history of trying to create peace in that region. The Hormuz Peace Plan, which was an initiative of the previous government in Iran, which aimed at establishing security, you know, in the region, including the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, and the Sea of Oman. And that initiative was planned to be with the participation of all countries of that region. And that's been really the foreign policy stance of the Islamic Republic. That's the default one. The trouble is that the presence of Israel and the foreign presence of America, because of course it's not part of West Asia, it's a perennial interference in that region, and its manipulation of some of the people within that region and some of the leaders particularly has led to essentially nothing but war, conflict, and plunder and pillaging. This is just on record. We only need to look at the record they have in terms of what they're doing in Palestine as far as Israel's concerned, what they did in Syria, what they've done in Iraq. All of these initiatives, which were a partnership of the Anglo-Zionist Empire, have led to nothing but instability in the region. Iran has always advocated the opposite. In fact, they could argue that it's because of the Islamic Republic of Iran that a lot of these fires that could have turned into huge destruction in that region have changed into far more settled, at least on the way to settling disputes and conflicts. You know, Iraq is one example. Iran's influence there has led to less sectarian, confrontation. It's led to the destruction of ISIS, which would have been a nightmare for everybody. Sure. In Syria, we've seen that the sovereignty of Syria was ultimately maintained to the best of the ability, and that was largely due to Iranian backup, I would say. And of course, we can see also for the rights of those oppressed in the region, where of course you can't have peace without justice. And I think Iran has stuck to that mantra as well, and that policy of saying, look, we need justice in this area, and for that, we need to all settle our issues in the West Asian region if we happen to be living here, not allow foreign powers, superpowers, to come in and dictate their agendas, which are usually based on their self-interest, economic interests, and, might I add, the destruction of Iran primarily and any other Arab or Muslim nation in that region that wants independence.
Sure. Well, I'm glad that you mentioned this Hormuz peace endeavor, of which Muhammad Ali Araki, I'm going to ask you, this was something that was introduced by the former Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. And it was years ago that he presented that. Actually, he went to the UN with it and talked about how this initiative to bring peace and stability, especially in the Strait of Hormuz and the Sea of Oman, is key. But he underlined that this can only be achieved through cooperation and dialogue without foreign interference, and that the regional countries must decide that on their own. Again, this would be in reference to only the two that Sayed Mohsen Abbas mentioned, which first and foremost would be the U.S., and maybe along with that, Israel. Years ago, why didn't that have the momentum required? Because we are still experiencing this foreign interference in the form of the U.S. in the region.
Yes, so the interference of the United States of America alongside the apartheid Zionist regime of Israel has been in the region in the past few years, but we have witnessed that, especially since the presence of President Ayatollah Raisi in the Islamic Republic of Iran, he has taken the path down a state of resolving things. We have witnessed a far more diplomatic activity by his government to resolve the problems and end the foreign interference. I personally believe that the the meeting that will be happening soon has a big influence in the peace that will come into the region, because the neighboring
countries... I'm sorry, can you tell us which meeting you were referring to? I didn't catch that.
Yes?
Which meeting are you referring to, the upcoming meeting you just stated? I didn't catch whom you were referring to.
By the meeting that will be by the Persian Gulf countries, they'll be coming, and Mr. Amir Abdullahian, he spoke about it today. There'll be a summit, and based on what I read, it will be taking place in Iran. Now, I believe that the neighboring countries of the Islamic Republic of Iran, especially the Persian Gulf countries, will reach the conclusion that Iran is a true friend for the days of hardship and the good days, and they'll realize, and we can see the change, that the apartheid regime of Israel and its allies are not that true good friend that has always been portrayed on the media. And we have had the different leaders of resistance focus on the fact that, and refer to it, that this normalization of ties between Israel and many Islamic countries, it's not going to last. I believe this meeting will be a turning point, and it will be a start for the situation changing, and we will be having more peace, hopefully, in the region. And as a result of that, the United States of America and its allies will have to pack up their suitcases and leave the region.
Sure. Well, you know, when you talk about the so-called normalization, say, Mohsen Abbas, what's key here, and it hasn't really been answered, and maybe you can help us in explaining this to us, is that one of the angles behind and the initiative behind this was to have Israel establish the so-called normalization, try to get these Persian Gulf Arab countries to entertain that, so that the U.S. wouldn't have to be as actively involved in the region, because then Israel's security would be somewhat established by these, well, whichever countries opted to do so, even though it hasn't really been entertained as much as I think they anticipated. Is that a correct reading into it?
I think we're all aware that the nations that we regard as the Gulf Cooperation Council, for instance, whether it's Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, we can name Saudi Arabia within that as well, the UAE, These forces or these entities have been established by the Anglo-Zionist Empire. They owe their establishment, the leaders owe their positions of power to the Western powers. And ever since their inception, they've been in the pockets of basically the Anglo-Zionist money mafia. And so essentially, they are tied at the hip with those, the interests of the West, and they do virtually everything in terms of their foreign policies, and I must say even their domestic and economic policies, which ultimately benefits the West. That doesn't help to really create a genuinely stable, conflict-free West Asia, because of course if you're not interested in your own people's interest in regional trade, in increasing the regional trade, using the energy of the region to help the world, if you're not really interested in having fraternal relationships or even military strategic alliances with your neighbors, that clearly means that you're missing out, for instance, on all sorts of economic benefits that could be there, which go beyond just oil and energy, relying on gas and oil, which is what those Gulf countries are doing. You're also destabilizing the region, and you're spending money on military and weapons, which you probably wouldn't have to. Now, the billions and billions of dollars which these Gulf countries pay to Lockheed Martin and all the sort of licenses for arms and weapons which the Americans and the United Kingdom and other Western countries are lavished with, ultimately benefit the West. They don't benefit these guys. They're sitting there, and every time they run out of these weapons or they get outdated, they go and buy some more. So basically, this relationship of milking the cows of that region has been going on by the West, and Iran is saying, look, you don't need to do this. You can save that money. You can diversify your economy. You can do more trade with your neighbors, especially sure. ourselves. And as a result, there would be prosperity, peace, and automatic sort of harmony in the region. If only they could have the nerve and the courage to step away from their puppet status with Israel, okay. Tel Aviv, with Washington.
Right. Well, that's what I want to ask you, Muhammad Ali Araki, in terms of the most recent visit of the Chinese president to the region, which was to Saudi Arabia. Now, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas talks about countries like Saudi Arabia that are tied to the hip when it comes to the West, in particular the U.S., obviously. But at the same time, we noticed how important now there's been a turn away, as it's been construed, of Saudi Arabia from the U.S., not completely, but we know the dissatisfaction and the tenseness that exists in that relationship. And it seems like... Well, it doesn't seem like it's very obvious that Saudi Arabia is turning to China in more ways than one, in particular when it comes to the oil card. Now, in this case in point, are we looking at a shift there, perhaps, of Saudi Arabia away from the U.S., and therefore we have on the other side of this how Iran is close to China also? So therefore, this both spells moves away from the U.S. Can it be construed that way? Something on which obviously we need to expand on more, because Iran's foreign minister talked about China in more ways than one after this visit. But what's your view on that?
Yes. So as I mentioned in the previous question that you asked about the meeting that will occur with the Persian Gulf countries, and that it will result in a shift, I believe that this is also... This will also result in a shift as well, because the relationship between Saudi Arabia and United States of America has become bitter in the current days, and the meeting of the Chinese official was a very important political message by Saudi Arabia to America and also the allies of China. And yes, we are looking at basically shift of power. And there's also one other thing I must mention, and that is the fact that when this shift occurs, there will also potentially be destabilization in the Persian Gulf countries and Saudi Arabia, because normally the United States of America, when they see that a country is not following their benefits, not in line with them, they would come and cause some so-called organic protests or chaos in the country. But again, the result of this shift, the reason to this shift that has occurred and is on the way of expansion occurring, is because of the fact that the United States of America and its allies are truly not trustworthy friends. Despite, yes, we know that the United States of America has a policy of milking the cow, but this sure. will no longer work.
Okay.
And the reason to that is because they have proven that they're not good friends. They are trustworthy friends to Saudi Arabia, despite we completely disagree with many of the policies that government of Saudi Arabia is implementing in the region.
Sure. Well, we need some explanation from you, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, when it comes to Iran vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia in terms of how there are talks that have occurred. Iraq has been the mediator, but we know that that hasn't really bore the fruits that perhaps either side wanted. At this point, that door is still open. Even the Iranian foreign minister, Amir Abdullahian, at the Tehran Dialogue Forum, has said that we do want to open up our consulates. But at the end of his statement, he said, if Saudi Arabia chooses to take a constructive approach when it comes to Iran, what are we looking at when it comes down to Saudi Arabia and Iran and the region as a whole, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas?
Well, just in the last month, you can see that Saudi Arabia was involved in most of the social media tweeting, which was inciting riots and violence in the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is literally occurrence that Saudi regime has been essentially part and parcel of the American color revolution destabilization efforts over the last month or two, we've seen that Saudi Arabia hasn't surrendered its policy in terms of oppressing Yemen, even though it was Iran at the beginning of this year whose initiative basically offered solutions, deal to end blockades in Yemen, to stop the war, and to create some rapprochement and harmony for the Saudis and for the Yemenis to get on with their lives without the kind of mass murders and killings that are going on through Saudi bombing, supplied, of course, by the Anglo-Zionist Empire with their arms as usual. So there are two bits of evidence to say the Saudis have shown no real sense of change. Okay, yes, we can take it on board that China has a huge a future impact on that region, what with the Belt and Road Initiative and Iran's tie up with them, Iraq has tied up. The Saudis clearly don't want to be left behind, and there's a lot of jostling going on. The Chinese are playing a very wily diplomatic game as well, and they actually came down literally on the side of the Gulf Arab countries in terms of three islands that belong obviously to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and yet China added its signature to the notion of, considering discussions. I mean, those are territorial issues which the Islamic Republic of Iran will not entertain. And if China did that to sweeten up the Saudis so that they would also buy into the Belt and Road Initiative, that's part of China's, of course, need for access to all of this region. But Iran won't buy into those. And if Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries continue to sort of challenge Iranian sovereignty, if they continue to be involved in color revolutions, if the Saudis continue to help finance ISIS offshoots along with the Americans, if they continue to try and destabilize that region with sectarian narratives, because we know that's been a major tool in trying to keep Iran, isolated. They've tried to make the Sunni fraternity across the Arab world and beyond actually dislike Iran and not engage with them at all. So these are not portents for a great relationship with Saudi Arabia anytime soon.
Sure. Well, I got, I think, four topics that I know we will not fit in the next few minutes left. Let's see. Let me go with Iraq with you on this, Mohammed Ali Araki, representative from Iraq at this Tehran Dialogue Forum said that Iraq cannot be used. He said many things which were actually quite incredible. But basically, we're looking at even the current prime minister of Iraq saying that Iraq cannot be used. Many Iraqi administrations have said that Iraq cannot be used as its soil to be used as a launching pad for attacks or any anti-government activities against the Islamic Republic. Tell us why he would say that, who he is referring to. In this case in point, we know that Iraq has talked about, and Iran has actually come out with Iraq against Iraqi Kurdistan and the groups operating out of there, these terrorist groups, they need to put a stop to it. I think they have formed some kind of group that is monitoring those activities. But how important is that? Because that obviously is very important for Iran, and it does contribute to maintaining regional peace and security to stop those anti-Iran activities coming from Iraqi Kurdistan.
So when we're talking about this, we're talking about the national security of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and including the neighbors of the Islamic Republic of Iran, because when the Kurdistan region of Iraq is unsafe and is a safe haven for the Zionists and other terrorists, this will have an impact on Iran and the other neighboring countries. So the Islamic Republic of Iran will not give in, and as we saw in the past few weeks, they did not give in, and they were very serious that if the necessary action was not taken, Iran will do what they see necessary. And so thankfully what we saw was that Mr. Al-Sudani, after the visit he made to the Islamic Republic of Iran, he took the case seriously, and now we witness that there have been troops deployed by the Iraqi government to enter that border in order to clamp down on any potential threats that will target the Islamic Republic.
Sorry to jump in again for lack of time. I got to give Mohsen Abbas the last question here. On Ukraine, so Mohsen Abbas, Iran has said, we didn't want this war from the beginning. We didn't agree with it, that is. And he said that Iran can even provide means for such a dialogue. Coming from Iran, in terms of this summit, the Tehran Dialogue Forum, and its promotion of peace. Tell us your thoughts of Iran on Ukraine war, and how can Iran be construed as a bad actor if it's all about peace? In about 30, 40 seconds.
Well, first of all, Iran was part of a message delivery service, if you like, the foreign minister, to the Russian foreign minister on behalf of a European nation, where they proposed a kind of peace deal around Ukraine, or the beginning of discussion around a peace deal. It was intimated that Macron, Francis Macron, was behind that, but the Iranians participated. If we look at Iran regionally, and this is a summary, really, look, they tried to help with peace in Afghanistan. They've offered all their services to continue to be a peaceful. They tried in the Azerbaijani dispute with Armenia, peace brokers, in Yemen, in all of the region that they've tried their utmost.
Thank you for that.
Continue their effort and try their best to push this, even though their enemies going to do their best to break up those efforts.
Sorry, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, fresh out of time. Thank you so much, journalist and political commentator. Mehmet Ali Araki, thank you, journalist and political analyst, both from London. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tavlay and the team, it's goodbye.
In the limelight. California Congressman Adam Schiff said on Sunday, 18th of December, that he believes there is sufficient evidence to criminally charge former President Donald Trump in relation to his efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. California Congressman Adam Schiff said on Sunday that he believes there is sufficient evidence to criminally charge former President Donald Trump in relation to his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Adam Schiff's dramatic statement on CNN's State of the Union program came just one day before the House January 6 Select Committee, to which he belongs, is poised to release an outline of its extensive investigative report on the U.S. Capitol attack, which has been linked to 9 deaths, including the suicides of traumatized law enforcement officers. The committee is expected to use its last meeting on Monday to refer Donald Trump, as well as others, to the U.S. Justice Department in relation to the former president's attempts to reverse his 2020 defeat to Joe Biden. During this final meeting, the House panel is expected to outline an executive summary of its findings, propose legislative recommendations, vote to adopt the report, and then vote on possible criminal and civil referrals. Adam Schiff is one of 9 members, 7 of whom are Democrats like him, serving on the January 6 committee. The potential referrals involving Donald Trump are expected to involve obstruction of an official congressional proceeding, as well as conspiracy to defraud the United States. The Guardian first reported the nature of these referrals. Adam Schiff told CNN host Jake Tapper that he can't comment on specifics of any possible referrals. The predicted criminal referrals are effectively symbolic, because Congress can't force prosecutors to pursue charges. I think that the evidence is there that Donald Trump committed criminal offenses in connection with his efforts to overturn the election, said Adam Schiff, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee. Adam Schiff added, "And viewing it as a former prosecutor, I think there's sufficient evidence to charge the former president." CNN host Jake Tapper asked Adam Schiff whether this was enough to secure a conviction. "Well, I don't know what the Justice Department has. I do know what's in the public record. The evidence seems pretty plain to me, but I would want to see the full body of evidence if I were in the prosecutor's shoes to make decision," Adam Schiff responded. But this is someone who in multiple ways tried to pressure state officials to find votes that didn't exist. This is someone who tried to interfere with a joint session of the Congress, even inciting a mob to attack the Capitol. If that's not criminal, then I don't know what it is. Asked whether he thought Donald Trump would face criminal charges, Adam Schiff said, "The short answer is I don't know. I think that he should face criminal charges. I think he should face the same remedy, force of law, that anyone else would." Adam Schiff said he was worried, however, that it may take until he is no longer politically relevant for justice to be served. "That's not the way it should be in this country, but there seems to be an added evidentiary burden with someone who has a large enough following. That simply should not be the case, but I find it hard otherwise to explain why, almost 2 years from the events of 6th of January 2021, and with the evidence that's already in the public domain, why the Justice Department hasn't moved more quickly than it has," Adam Schiff said. The Guardian previously reported that Trump allies who might face criminal referrals include former high-ranking White House staffers. The panel is also expected to make civil referrals to the House Ethics Committee involving Republican Congress members, as well as suggest disbarment of some of Donald Trump's attorneys. The January 6th committee has largely concluded that the insurrection was rooted in a conspiracy, sources previously told Guardian. The panel, the House panel, found that Donald Trump oversaw a political plan for his vice president, Mike Pence, to refuse to certify election results in a joint session of Congress on 6th of January 2021, as well as a coup plot to force Congress's hand if he refused. Committee investigators think that Donald Trump's alleged desire to illegally thwart the certification of the election he lost was obvious months before 6th of January 2021. They believe it extended from the time he agreed with a fake electoral plot so states would swap Biden's Electoral College votes for him until he refused for hours to call off Capitol attackers. Donald Trump did not leave documentary evidence of his alleged involvement, but his staffers left a paper trail. During Trump's presidency, he used his power to stifle inquiries, the House committee is expected to say. NBC News has also covered the same story. Representative Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, said on Sunday that the House January 6th committee has evidence that former President Donald Trump broke the law, but he declined to get specific about the criminal referrals it could make ahead of the House panel's final meeting on Monday. In an interview on CNN's State of the Union program, Adam Schiff, a member of the committee, cited multiple efforts by Donald Trump to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, including pressuring state officials to go along with his false claims of widespread election fraud. "If that's not criminal, then I don't know what is," he said. Adam Schiff, however, declined to comment on the possible referrals the committee could make, saying the panel is set to vote on them and will reveal its decision on Monday, as well as release his final report this month. "But I can tell you that our process has been to look meticulously at the evidence and compare it to various statutes. If there is sufficient evidence as to each element of a particular crime," he said, "we are not referring, or at least won't be voting to refer anyone we think there may be evidence, because we want to focus on those for which we believe there's the strongest evidence. The committee, which has been forecasting the possibility of referring Donald Trump to the Justice Department for a crime, is actively considering charges of insurrection, obstruction of an official proceeding of Congress, and conspiracy. While all three charges are possible, the House panel has not yet made a final decision, three sources involved in the committee's deliberations said last week. The potential recommendations are not necessarily reserved for Donald Trump, and they could also include referrals to other government agencies or to the House Ethics Committee. California Congressman Adam Schiff reiterated that he thinks Trump violated multiple criminal laws and should be prosecuted like any other American who breaks the law. Asked whether the House panel will refer members of Congress who ignored subpoenas from the panel to the Ethics Committee, Adam Schiff said its decision on the appropriate remedy for those lawmakers, who include Representatives Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, and Scott Perry, a Republican from Pennsylvania, will also be made public on Monday. We have weighed, what is the remedy for members of Congress? Is it a criminal referral to another branch of government, or is it better that Congress police its own, he said, adding that the House panel has considered censure and ethics referrals.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.